Hello, I'm Oliver Wong.
And I'm Morgan Rhodes. You're listening to Heat Rocks.
Every episode, we invite a guest to join us to talk about Heat Rock, you know, an album filled with fire and brimstone. And today, we are headed to the Sweet Forever, talking about It's Gonna Rain Again, the 1972 gospel album from the sensational Nightingales.
I want to rest at the closing of the day. I know there'll be joy awaiting there for me.
Most music scholars will tell you that every genre has a golden age. For gospel music, that golden age was the 1950s. Though the gospel quartet wasn't discovered in the 50s, the unique quartet, the Dinwiddie colored quartet, and the standard quartet were some of the earliest recorded. The 1950s can be credited as a renaissance for a string of fresh talents, four members of a variety of groups brought together with a dual purpose, to set at liberty those who are afflicted, and to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. The gospel quartet wasn't just four singers. It was four-part harmony, selected and perfected by groups like the Highway QCs, the Swan Silvertones, the Pilgrim Travelers, the Flying Clouds of Detroit, the Southern Sons, the Caravans, the Davis Sisters, the Soul Stirrers, and the sensational Nightingales, founded in 1942 by Barney Parks, a founding member of the Dixie Hummingbirds. Julius Cheeks, Ernest James, Bill Woodruff, John Jefferson, and guitarist JoJo Wallace sang folks to smithereens, a joyful noise that continued on into the 1972 release of It's Gonna Rain Again. Rain shows up often in the Bible. The latter rain, the former rain, Noah's dilemma, both as an agent of destruction, the extended hand of God's justice, and a restorative property, the evidence of God's mercy. On this album, and please allow this very liberal use of a metaphor, rain in It's Gonna Rain is, at least to me, a representative of the washing away of gospel convention. This album is both country-leaning and blues-leaning. It is doo-wop-ish and traditional. Its songs belong to the struggle, and many have remained precious and prevalent, preserved by today's generation. The lack of in-the-boxness on this album and the themes present here represent relationship with God and not ritual, a pattern for loving and not just living, that singers used to shout at us in the 50s, sometimes instead of whispering. There is a contemporary vibe about this album, even after 40-plus years of its release. Goodness, that lasted long enough to see me sitting with one of my favorite artists to discuss it. How perfect. The church girl gets to talk gospel. And while it may be new information to some folks, me and the sensational Nightingales been new. Jesus is King.
The last mile of the way, I want to rest at the closing of the day. I know there'll be joy.
It's Gonna Rain Again was the album pick of our guest today, Van Hunt. If I had been reading some liner notes a bit more carefully back in 1997, I would have noticed one of Van's earliest official credits as the co-writer of one of my favorite songs that year, Hopeless, recorded by Dion Ferris for the Love Jones soundtrack.
I stayed just a little too long. Now it's time for me to move on.
They say I'm home.
That was a Heat Rock.
Yes.
It was an auspicious start for this Dayton native who eventually relocated to Atlanta and stayed on his grind as a songwriter and musician until emerging as an artist in his own right in 2004 with his self-titled debut. In the time since, he's been a consistently inventive and eclectic soul slinger, having rolled out a slew of albums, including On the Jungle Floor, The Fun Rises, The Fun Sets, and most recently, just earlier this year, Trim, a revisit to his debut album on the occasion of its 15th anniversary. We often talk about cover songs here on Heat Rocks, but this is a rare case where an artist has recorded an entire cover album of their own material, armed with some vintage drum machines, no less, as Trim finds Van Hunt reimagining the songs of his younger years, including his first hit from 2003, Seconds of Pleasure.
Ooh, girl, it's what you say. Written on your face. It's rain.
Van Hunt, welcome to Heat Rocks.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you. You know, you guys are really good together. This is quite a dynamic duo.
We try.
Thank you. What was your introduction, please, to Sensational Nightingales and also to this album?
I am not a churchgoer. I'm not. I'm barely spiritual. I grew up in Dayton, very much surrounded by blues and rhythm. Mm. And I made my way to Atlanta as in the hip-hop scene, still doing R&B, and I met a fella by the name of Curtis Whitehead, and we became songwriting partners. Mm. Now, Curtis, on the other hand, grew up in a large family, and they would literally go through the hills of Georgia helping communities start their churches.
Mm.
And once the church began services, they would then become the band for the church for a little while until they could get things going.
Sure.
And this was a completely charitable act by the Curtis's father. But Curtis was very much steeped in the gospel canon. Mm. And he recognized, before I did, the gospel leanings in what I was doing. So he didn't dump me right into gospel quartet. He took me through Al Green first, thankfully, and then a little Curtis Mayfield. And then he was like, man, let me take you to my house. And then he broke it down with the Canton Spirituals and all kinds of gospel quartet groups. And then one of the records that I just couldn't let go of was the Sensational Nightingales, It's Gonna Rain Again. And it really bothered me because I was like, if it's going to rain again, it rained before. Where is the "it's going to rain"?
Sure.
So I was asking everybody in Curtis's family, like, where is the "it's going to rain"? And they tried to explain to me that that was just a song that Julius Cheeks had written.
Sure.
And then the Julius Cheeks left the Sensational Nightingales, and they reformed with Charles Johnson and did an album, "It's Going to Rain Again." So once I finally wrapped my mind around that, then the scientist in me could settle down and listen to the album, which is just an amazing album.
Mm-hmm.
That was really like a sleeping agent for me. And I just curled up with it every night and listened to it along with Sade and Sly Stone. Which,
We're going to talk about Sly Stone a little bit later. So
okay.
Good you brought him up.
It's interesting that you mentioned that you did not grow up listening to gospel music. You don't come from a church family. I'm very much the same way. And mm-hmm. so I connect with gospel music in a way that I can't really quite explain. It has nothing to do with faith because I lack that aspect of it, but there's still something in it. Maybe it's the sincerity. Maybe it's that it's the jubilation that mm-hmm. these singers are bringing to what it is that they're singing about.
Mm-hmm.
What is it for you that you connect with, especially in this album?
Oh, it's the same thing. And I can relate to Morgan in that we both came up in the AUC area, yeah. Atlanta University College area. And, you know, through that teaching, I learned about a guy named John Henry Clark.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about how the Greeks and Romans came into Africa, into Egypt specifically. And he said, you know, they found these people treating each other very nicely. And he said they would ask the Egyptians, like, what do you call this thing you guys have? And it's like, nothing. This is just how we treat each other. And he said they didn't even have a name for jail or punishment or anything mm-hmm. like that. And he said a very entrepreneurial Roman was like, man, we could take this and turn it into something. He said and suddenly they had a name. They started calling it Christianity. And he said, but that's not about, you know, that's a business. He said, that, you know, how you treat people is where what the reality mm-hmm. is. And that's what I hear in that music. And particularly with Charles Johnson, when he sings, there's a very earnestness in his voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in fact, I know some of the stories with him and Julius Cheeks where they were both, you know, very serious about the word in their music and would actually fall out with members within their own group because they weren't living by, you know, the, mm-hmm. the words in the song.
Oh, yeah. You better hold on. God doesn't change your hand. Oh yeah, you better build your hopes on the eternal.
Morgan, you grew up with gospel.
Oh yes.
So what does gospel mean for you?
It was just the music, you know, the music of the household. And of course, this generation of gospel music, quartets belong to my grandmother and her brother's generation. We went to spent a lot of summers with my grandmother in Waco, Texas. I got baptized in Waco, Texas, and we would go drive out to the country. My grandmother was wealthy, and she had a nice Cadillac, powder blue, and she'd ask the kids who wanted to go to church, and I was the only one that wanted to go, and so it'd just be me and her, you know. And we would go to these things in the country called tent revivals, and at tent revivals we would hear quartets, and so. This is how I came to know this sort of music, this vibe, although I didn't know the bands. And the first time I heard a quartet was we went to a revival, and it was supposed to be me and her and my cousin. He was the only one at home that day. He wasn't really saved, though, and he wasn't trying to go. And so he was jawing, you know, talking a little, you know, mess, you know, in the kitchen, really, really underappreciating the sort of bionic ears of black women. So he didn't think that my grandmother heard him. And he was saying a few things, you know, he didn't want to go, blah, blah, blah. He wasn't listening to that type of music. So my grandmother came in there and she said, seems like you're mumbling. And he said, I'm not mumbling. She said, I didn't say that. It says, seems like you're mumbling, right? And so I ended up rolling in the front seat. It was just my privilege. And we went to this tent revival and heard the first gospel quartet. And so this was the music that, as a little kid, I heard first. It wasn't until I got older that I started to hear more contemporary gospel. Andre Crouch, Edwin Hawkins, Walter Hawkins, and Love Alive, such and such. But that's how I came to know it. And growing up in the church, this is just what you heard. I think gospel quartets in general, not just the 50s, but that kind of gospel belongs to a specific sort of section of black folks and black Christians. It reminds me of older black men, you know, ushers, deacons, love Jesus, but keep a bottle of Hennessy, speak in tongues, but may curse you out in the parking lot, love Al Green, but also love Jesus, and this sort of instrumentation, which was a departure from the piano and the Hammond organ.
Yeah. So
that was my introduction, long-winded way of saying I'm not new to this.
Well, what's interesting, and this is, of course, the first time I've ever heard this particular gospel album, is that it surprised me to realize that it had been recorded in 72.
Sure.
Because it does not sound like 72. It sounds like 62, and parts of it sound like 52, because it's about maintaining the tradition rather than, and certainly there were other gospel groups coming out in the 70s that were very much contemporary with where black music in general,
sure,
secular music was at the time. This is not them.
It's not them. And I almost made a mistake with this because I almost pitched this for Selma. I almost pitched at the meeting because I found this album and that song working on Selma. And I saw it in a bunch of, like, you know, packed in a bunch of 60s quartets.
Right.
And I believed it because that's how it sounded, really 50s and 60s.
I want to be at the meeting. Yeah, I want to be at the meeting. Yes, I do. I want to be at the meeting. When all...
Had I put that in there, I just would have been...
Anachronistic, as they say.
Oh, yeah. Somebody would have...
Someone would have called you out and be
really
like,
Morgan.
I might have some information, though, that might... It might, I don't know. It might upset you.
Go in.
Go on. Amen.
Because that troubled me, too. Because I said, I should at least know when this record was recorded. I assumed the record had been recorded in the late 50s. And so I called up Curtis, I did, and I was like, Curtis, this record sounds like a late 50s record, man.
Right.
But I said, but the label says 72, some label says 75. He was like, yeah, it does sound late 50s, early 60s. He said, all I know is I think that the Nightingales went to Nashville. And he said, and it was the first time they recorded with a band, like a full band. He said, and I do think that it was one of the times Julius Cheeks left. He said, and the first time Charles Johnson enters the band, the group, it's late 50s, early 60s. He said, I think they recorded it then.
Oh.
And they reissued, they issued the record. He's like, because when you go around, not many people, even in the gospel quartet arena, know about this record, this album. He said, it's actually not a popular album. And he said, I think it's for that reason, is that it kind of set around. And then they issued the album in the 70s.
Well, damn.
Makes sense, though.
Yeah. It very very much feels like a late 50s, early 60s
yep.
record.
Right, which explains the sound of it.
Yeah.
Yep.
But it also makes me think, too, one of the thoughts I had about, again, my very nascent understanding of gospel as not just like a style, but really also as an industry, is that even if gospel and secular pop music as industries ran in parallel, they still operated very differently in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that just strikes me is that you can have a band here that was formed in the mid-1940s that was still recording, still touring 30 years later in the 70s. And obviously, you know, the personnel might have changed here and there. But just to have that kind of longevity is completely normal in the gospel world, in the way in which, you know, in secular pop, that you get your 15 seconds if that much, and then everything might end. And so that longevity is one part of it. And that these records circulate. They can be incredibly popular without ever mapping onto the rest of the pop world. In other words, that you can have hit gospel albums that are people are just completely unaware of if you're not part of this community of listeners.
Sure.
And this is something that I learned, because when you try to find gospel records as a collector, you might get lucky and sometimes these things will cross over into a record store. But for the most part, distribution, where they were sold at the retail end, they didn't go through the same kind of distribution networks that like your Motowns or whoever else did.
Sure.
Like it's a very different system, a different world. Even if the music might sound similar, it still operates on a distribution and an infrastructural level completely separate in a lot of ways.
And there aren't as many labels. When you look up gospel albums and you're trying to collect on Discogs, it'll be the same four or five labels, right?
A lot of indie labels, though.
A lot of indie labels that did all of that.
Right, the big ones.
The big ones. And to your point earlier, the longevity in gospel is because gospel is a genre that you can't age out of. No one's going to be like, oh, he's 50 years old,
right,
still trying to sing gospel.
Right.
No one's going to say that. It is your value increases the longer you live, because then your testimony's earned and not learned, right?
Mm.
So you're going to be, a lot of these singers will be 65 years old out there still singing, because you're never going to be too old for
right,
gospel.
Right. Yeah. It's not youth music in the same way.
It is not youth music.
Soul of mine, Lord, give me a heart like thine, oh Jesus. Only.
We had Lee Fields on here, and he was talking about Sam Cooke, A Portrait of a Legend. And I asked him, did he think that Sam Cooke was a soul singer influenced by gospel, or a gospel singer with a side of soul? And he said that he thought that soul music was gospel's first cousin. And he said that gospel is about the when and the then. So my question to you is, what, in your opinion, what makes gospel music? Is it more about style or content? Like, if you didn't know this was a gospel album, you took away the words, just the arrangements and the guitar and stuff, could this be another type of album, or is this specific to gospel music?
I think it's tempting to say that it could be another type of album, but it's impossible to remove all of those parts.
Yeah,
you know, because the whole thing about identifying something is when you take things out, what's the impression is still there.
Yeah,
and you know, that's kind of what Oliver was relating to when he listens to this music.
Sure,
and even as an atheist or as an agnostic, he's still left with the impression.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
It's kind of hard. It's impossible, actually, to separate those things, because one forms the other.
Mm.
You know, and so when you ask me what gospel is, it's the desire to share a kind of beauty with people and rhythm.
Right.
And when you have that, you know.
And even when gospel singers or singers that have grown up in the church aren't singing gospel, you still hear that. So you also can't take out the skeleton of mm-hmm. gospel.
Mm-hmm.
I was listening to The Sweet Inspirations the other day,
mm-hmm.
and I was like, "Yo!" And you know, they spent a lot of time backing up Elvis Presley, but to me, that's just Clara Ward and the Caravans all over again. They may be backing up Elvis Presley,
yeah,
but that is straight ahead gospel. And we want to make sure we include the women quartets in this discussion.
Oh, no doubt, right?
Because they were putting it down.
And I think to your point, Morgan, it's that We talk a lot about, we are focused on singers, right? That the ones who grew up in the church, you can just tell in their inflection, how they do their runs,
yep,
which is very different from those singers who might have amazing voices, great technical skills, But you can tell when they didn't grow up in the church because they just the way they approach a song, the way they approach a note is going to be different. Which is why I was thinking we got into this when we were talking about Bill Withers, and that Withers had, you know, an amazing voice, but he did not sound like he came out of the church, which was very different than, like, let's say an Al Green, who clearly comes from that particular background.
Right. Yeah. And some of the R&B singers today, somebody tweeted a couple of weeks ago, like, I want more R&B singers that grew up in the church. Right. Mm-hmm. Because I think her point was, like, we're losing the Fantasias and the Faith Evans mm-hmm. and the Kelly Prices, and they're giving way to another generation. And her point was sort of like, you know, these young singers of the day don't know anything. And then Ari Lennox did a little video of her singing a Kurt Carr, We Raise Our Hands in the Sanctuary. And the surprise was like, oh, we didn't really know, you know.
Right.
Yeah. The Kurt Carr was like, listen, I love do you want to go on tour? Like, this was fantastic. So.
And now it's up to Kanye to bring gospel back into.
Oh my God!
We don't need to get into that, though.
Lord,
we don't need to get into that. Though I will say we are taping this episode the weekend that Jesus
that
is King
Jesus
came out.
Jesus King is released, yeah.
And it might be a future episode. Who knows?
Listen,
we'll have to see.
What did you think sets the Sensational Nightingales apart from other quartets? Like, we've talked about a few of them, and I think everyone has their own personality. They're not the Mighty Clouds of Joy. They're not the Blind Boys of Alabama, and they're certainly not the Gaither Brothers, okay, or the Oak Ridge Boys. Yeah. But what do you think makes them distinct, their sound distinct?
You know, the grit stands out to me. And, you know, you hear people say all the time that Wilson Pickett or whomever borrowed from the quartet groups. But I think Oliver was saying something about the difference in gospel singers versus secular singers. And it does, once you, and this happened to Sam Cooke too, once you step out of the gospel arena, you're actually stepping into something more constrained.
Mm.
And you do, you're going to approach your songs differently.
Mm.
Because in gospel, it's different. Like, you're singing to worship something.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can give of yourself in a very, very different way. It's completely without a self-centeredness, you know. And,
right.
And when you actually step into the church, if you don't do it with a kind of a community village feel, everybody knows it. And so they immediately have a distrust of what you're doing.
You Absolutely.
Know, there's not a lot of soloing that goes on, you know, in the gospel arena.
No.
So when you do that, you're kind of showing out. You know what I mean? And it means, like, you're not there to worship the Lord.
Right.
And so it immediately means something different. But when you drive all of the music towards something that is climactic, it's about, you know, complete worship and, you know, it's very different. That's a different thing. You're soloing for the Lord.
Right. Wow. And if you show out in church, someone is going to pull that
That's
car
right.
and be like, wait a minute now.
That's right.
Wait a minute. You're doing too much with these. Listen, you up here doing too much, okay? You brought up Sam Cooke, and I wanted to play and I love the Sensational Nightingales, and I love that you picked this album. Mm-hmm. The Soul Stirs are near and dear to my heart, primarily because of Sam Cooke. Mm-hmm. But I mean, overall, I love quartets in general because so many singers came out of there. You got Johnny Taylor, you got Lou Rawls. I mean, come on, it gave rise to a bunch of them. But I love the Soul Stirs and Sam Cooke. And I was in prep for the chat. I found a little bit of a concert that they did in 1955 here in LA at the Shrine. I mean, this clip is almost 8 minutes long, and then they get into some, like, where, I mean, for lack of a better interpretation, it just gets into Holy Ghost territory, where there's no arrangements, where we're just going back and forth, right? But the one thing that was striking to me about this is how similar, I mean, exactly the same to me, Sam Cooke sounded, whether he was singing his songs, you know, his secular songs, or this. Mm-hmm. Still the same Sam Cooke. Mm-hmm. No real adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a little bit more polish.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't really his voice. I think that was the arrangements. So circling back to your point, there is something that's different about how gospel music is put together that keeps it in that gospel category.
Yeah, because
same
Sam,
though.
You can just grab from such a wider array of tools, you know, when you're talking about gospel music versus secular music, particularly then, because you step into the secular world, like you said, there are now arrangements, there are now formats we're shooting for.
Yeah.
Right.
It's a very different thing, and I hear the difference in Sam just simply through the cycling. Like, you have to listen to Sam live with the Soul Stirrers to understand that, you know, what's his first hit as a pop solo guy?
You send me?
Yeah. You know, to hear the reservation there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's a very different thing, and that's a beautiful song.
Yeah.
But Sam live with the Soul Stirrers and his brothers pushing him, and those ladies in the front row, you know, throwing things, everything that they possibly can, and still remain spiritual.
Yeah. Remain.
It's a very, very, very different thing. And like you said, there's a reason, you know, you start talking about the Holy Ghost. You know, imagine singing something so well that it conjures up something that was not there before.
Sure.
Something invisible, something scary and haunting.
Sure, sure. You
know, that's a real power.
We will be back with more of our conversation with Van Hunt about the sensational Nightingales' It's Gonna Rain Again after a brief word from some of our sibling Max Fun podcasts. Keep it locked.
We interrupt the podcast you're listening to tell you about another podcast. That's right. We Got This with Mark and Hal.
That's correct, Mark. This is Hal. We do the hard work for you, settling all of the meaningless arguments you have with your friends.
So tune in every week on the Maximum Fun Network for We Got This with Mark and Hal, and all your questions will be asked and answered.
You're welcome.
All right, that's enough of that.
We got this.
Hi, I'm Biv.
And I'm Teresa.
And we host When Bev Mother, a comedy podcast about parenting.
Whether you are a parent or just know kids exist in the world, join us each week as we honestly share what it's like to be a parent. Yeah, I mean, I guess it all starts with I'm awakened by children and I've never...
There are children in my house.
They're waking me up. And, like, the coffee doesn't even work anymore.
Oh, I know.
I've been drinking so much coffee for so many years straight now. It doesn't do anything. Like, it just only makes sure I don't get a headache, probably.
It's more medicinal now.
Yeah.
Than, like,
I have to just drink it so that I don't probably get a headache.
So join us each week as we judge less, laugh more, and remind you that you are doing a great job.
Find us on MaximumFun.org, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back on Heat Rocks talking the sensational Nightingales' It's Gonna Rain Again with Van Hunt.
Van, if we can just take a brief detour, I wanted to ask you about Trim, which I mentioned at the very top. You have revisited your self-titled debut album that you released 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of artists who don't like revisiting their earlier work. I mean, some of them refuse to even perform those songs at concerts, even if it's their early hits. Mm-hmm. What made you want to revisit and not just revisit, re-record, in essence, reimagine is the phrase that you use, which I think is a good one. What made you want to go back to your first album and re-record it?
Well, much like the other artists, it's probably something I wouldn't have even thought of. But when I reconnected with my manager, he said, hey, we're coming up on the 15th anniversary. We need to do something special to mark the date. And he's like, why don't you know, look at recording that material? I think he thought that it would be something a much more traditional kind of thing that might not sound as different from the original. But, you know, me being, you know, a creative, I just wanted to see how far I could distort it and turned it into something unrecognizable.
Yeah.
You know, and something that was challenging for me.
A question that we often ask when we have guests here in talking about whatever album is the focus is, what do you hear differently about that album now as opposed to when you first encountered it? Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, for your own work, were there new things that you were hearing in your own material 15 years later in sitting down to re-record it?
Well, it was frightening, to be honest, when I started going back through these songs, and I started to feel like I had written those songs then for me to use now as a 48-year-old man.
Wow.
The 23-year-old who wrote Who Will Love Me in Winter had no idea what those lyrics were about, But the 48-year-old was like, oh.
Well, even if you didn't know that, it was fire then and now, whether you knew
or
not.
I needed that. You know, it was cathartic. It was medicinal. It was very useful to me. So I was thankful for the process. It was something I very much needed.
Do you have a favorite reimagining off of Trim? And maybe this is almost a sacrilegious question to ask. Is there a song on Trim that you actually like better than the version that you recorded for Van Hutt?
Oh, well, now I'd probably say all of them. but
oh, that's a true perfectionist answer right there.
Well, because I felt so much more confident as a singer than I did 15 years ago.
Yeah.
But probably it's a tie between Out of the Sky and like Hello Goodbye. Mm. Because I was able to really dig into what I would now call a foundational part of me, which is the gospel quartet, which I didn't have before. I had it within me, but it took someone to point that out.
Sure. Yeah.
And the old blues, which is within me and very much a part of my DNA. So I was able to just reveal those in a way that I felt like was exciting.
Yeah.
D'Angelo said a couple of years ago, someone was asking him, what are you going to do next? And he said, I'd like to be a part of a gospel quartet. Mm-hmm. My question for you would be, if you could be a part of a gospel quartet, who'd be in the final four besides you?
Well, that is a question.
Dead or living. It's cool. Dead or living.
Well, coincidentally, I had decided to start cutting songs from this album a couple of years ago, because I finally got Curtis Whitehead to cut some gospel quartet stuff for me, and he chose this record. Mm-hmm. And so we've already sang, actually, a couple of them, and we were trying to put a gospel quartet together when you guys called about this.
Oh, wow.
So it's just a coincidence. But if I were putting a quartet together today, I would definitely choose D'Angelo. Mm-hmm. Because he understands it intuitively. But I'd very much go female, because you don't hear enough of it,
I love you, man. I appreciate that, man.
And I very much like Baby Rose. I like her instincts.
Oh, yes.
Because she has roots, to the older style.
And that tone.
Yeah, yeah. And I'd go and get Chaka, because she would just make everybody laugh and feel comfortable, and it would be okay. Nobody would be mad at Chaka for, soloing.
No. So it would be you, Baby Rose, Curtis, and Chaka?
Me, Baby Rose, D'Angelo.
D'Angelo and Chaka. Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. Okay.
That's a good squad right there.
For sure. For sure. And I wanted to, I'm glad that we're talking about sort of modern day quartet possibilities, because a lot of talk lately has circled around, or for the last few years, over the Hamiltones, which is the backing band, of course, of Anthony Hamilton.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that could only mean one thing. One more time.
Baby,
you
Lord,
used to call me on my cell phone. You got late night when you need my love.
Are they doing Drake?
Yeah, Hotline Bling. And I've been praying for them ever since.
Yes.
But they do a lot of quartet stuff, and they all grew up singing in the church. And so in as much as we love this music, and some people, have things to say about the younger generation, this music has stood the test of time. Mm. It shows up in a lot of young artists, a lot of R&B artists. And I wanted to play a little piece of something else that went viral on YouTube with some kids. They had to be like 15 or 16.
Yeah. Hold on.
Woo.
Hold on.
Oh.
Hold on.
Yeah. Hold on.
Hold on. Hold on.
Braces, like 15 or 16 years old, just in the living room. You could tell one had been eating a sucker. His tongue was all blue. But it was really a shout out to this time. So
yeah.
the hope of glory is not dead in this generation.
No. Well, it's funny because we just taped an episode about Jodeci, and all the singers in Jodeci got their start as church singers. And so you can imagine if YouTube had been around there, that would have been like the early iteration of like a Jodeci.
For sure.
Before they lost their way for at least a little bit.
Little bit. Also worth mentioning, Fantasia is their first cousin. So they all grew up in the church.
Bringing this back to It's Going to Rain Again, if you had to pick a fire track off of this album, what's it going to be?
My God.
Oh, man. I'm going to say God's Accountant. Or Athame.
When I get to Jordan, walk Jordan like a man, buckle my sword right off my side.
See, I only have to break from you on one aspect there. That is kind of funky.
It is. It is very, very funky.
The kick drum is just right.
And the guitar. The guitar is doing really interesting work there as well.
And I love how he pronounces Jordan. The first time I heard that, I was like, see, this reminds me of my uncles and them. Country, Jesus-loving country, black men. Gotta love it.
So what is it about this song that just gets you?
The kick drum. Yeah. It really pulses in a way that, I think visually about everything, but it pulses in a way that pushes, I imagine the song being stretched, in a very comfortable but sensual way. It's so beautiful. And then Charles Johnson's voice is perfect. And I suspect that's probably him playing guitar, too.
Yeah.
And who's ever the baritone in this is killing on this song, too.
It's interesting, too, because the Spotify version of this album leads with At the Meeting. But that's not the first song in the original LP version, which is the title track, It's Going to Rain Again. And so I've always been curious why they resequenced it for, I guess, I'm assuming CD, which is now the version that's on Spotify. But because I'd never heard the album before, I thought At the Meeting was actually a great opener, just in terms of just immediately pulling you into who they are, what their sound is, what the kind of feel of this was going to be. It worked really well as a lead cut, even though I think It's Going to Rain Again. I mean, that's my fire track.
Oh, is it?
We can get into in a moment. But how about you, Morgan?
You put me in a tough position, a tough spot here. I go back and forth between Hold to God's Unchanging Hand and I Like the Old Account. That's probably my favorite because, unless I'm mistaken, it's the only track on the album where you hear the Hammond organ. It's my favorite because it for me encapsulates exactly how I grew up and how I came to know gospel. It reminds me of my earliest days as a 7 or 8 year old kid in church, and I love that organ. It is very churchy. It is very pat your foot. It is all those things.
Yeah.
Hold to God's Unchanging Hand is just precious to me because it belongs to so many generations of church folks and so many generations of black folks. And I wanted to play a little bit of Carlton Pearson and an album that he did. He had a song called Old School Medley, and it's his reinterpretation of this song. Mm-hmm.
God's unchanging hand. Come on and help me sing it quiet.
It was the first time I'd ever heard that song big like that. I've always sort of heard it in a quartet setting, but I liked it as a big choir thing.
It reminds me of my teenage years when my mom was able to get me to go to church, and every Sunday sounded like that.
Yep.
Like a quartet gospel song with a huge choir.
With a huge choir.
So best of all worlds.
Yep. those two are real precious to me. What about you?
So my fire track is the song that literally talks about fire, which is the title track, It's Going to Rain Again.
Lord, you better get ready and bear this in mind. God showed no the rainbow sign. He said it won't be water.
but fine next time.
This is what Noah told me.
If you're not familiar with the story of Noah, or you never read James Baldwin, you might be caught off guard here in terms of, and I'll just quote again from the line that the singer sing, is that God showed Noah the rainbow sign. He said it won't be water, but fire next time. Mm. And it's easy to forget that the Old Testament God was savage. And the thing is, when I was listening to this the first time through, it's so sweet the way that they sing it, but the warning that's being invoked here is mad sinister. Right. You know, it's like, if you continue your wicked ways, I'm not going to send the flood.
That's it.
I'm just going to rain fire on y'all.
That's
it. You know, I'm a Sodom and Gomorrah you.
That's it.
Again.
That's it.
And there's just that juxtaposition between, oh, this sounds so lovely and so sweet. And it's like, wait, what did they say? You know? Yeah.
This is my favorite background vocal part, that song. The rainbow. I love when he does that.
Let's hear some of that.
They tell me when the water began to pour. They knocked on the window. They knocked on the door. They didn't know exactly what to do.
You just get lulled into a false sense of security.
Yeah.
They singing straight out of Exodus. But you don't realize that God is about to burn out on you. He's blacking out.
I also just love how much work the guitar does.
Mm.
And the drumming as well. I mean, the drumming is very subtle. You know, this is not someone who's soloing on a trap set. They're just kind of keeping the pace.
Sure.
But as minimalist as the music is, it just adds so much to the feel of it and gives it whatever this inevitable quality we've been trying to dance around. Mm. Of course, in addition to the voices, but like the guitar work on here is just so striking.
Killing.
I'm wondering if each of you have a favorite moment on the album.
Oh, yes.
And for me, it came listening to At Calvary, which in a lot of ways opens it. For me, it just sounds like a country song, the particular instrumentation and the style of it. But when they get to that hook where they just sing the word Calvary and then the background vocals exactly. harmonize,
yeah.
it's magical.
Calvary.
Calvary. Calvary,
just those inflections on a single word with a little organ.
Organ.
Hammond's also in the background. That works as well.
That was the first song I redid when we recorded it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Why that one?
Probably because it was the easiest. Mm. You know, I love his voice on there.
Yeah.
Now, you know, he just delivers it in a very natural way. Yeah, and so next we did Heart Like Thine because it's one of my favorite too.
And that song has one of my favorite moments. I love how personal the song is. It's less about global spirituality and really personal.
Mm.
And I love that, you know, in between there's a little conversation, especially when he gets to 133, about 133 in the song. And he's like, I want to call you Jesus. Can you play that around there, Christian?
A heart like thine.
I want to call you Jesus and tell you to come to my soul.
Come to my soul. Blessed Jesus.
Morgan, you really are into the ad-libs and the monologues.
So into
you just
that.
Like it when they break out of the song and they just want to talk to you.
That's it.
Right.
That's it. Don't talk.
Listen. Yes,
just listen.
Yes, exactly.
Shout out to Jodeci. But this is what I miss from 90s R&B. Bring back interludes. Bring back voicemail messages. Bring back interrupted arrangements with conversation. But I love this song. I think it's precious.
Van, you clearly have sat with this album many, many times over the years. Mm. Is there a favorite moment that jumps out to you that every time you listen to this, just that,
That was one of them.
Yeah.
I want to come to you, Jesus, and tell you to come to my soul.
I
love that because he's kind of reminding you, you know, like that this is a spiritual song and he's guiding you through the darkness, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he does that again, I think about a minute later after he does that. And it really just helps drive the song because you feel how it's kind of a dirge and it's kind of slow, but he really drives it, you know, into something that is, you know, it's orgasmic. Mm. Can I say that?
No.
You can.
No, I'll mess with you. Oh, I wanted to circle back a little bit because we brought up Sly Stone I don't know how we got on the conversation of him, but I wanted to play one of his earliest songs, which was when he was singing gospel. I think he was a 11 or 12 year old kid then.
Yeah. I'm gonna walk out in my Jesus name. I've been false accused so many times. I bear the blame. I'm gonna live a Christian life. God knows I'm not ashamed.
You know I'm going. So to the point earlier, so many singers started in gospel, remained in gospel, but went on to secular lives. But you can still hear the gospel in your voice. And I always thought that "I Want to Take You Higher" had sort of a worship song qualities.
Yeah, absolutely.
Van, if you had to describe this album in three words, what would you choose?
Pure and raw. It's kind of the same thing. And just touching.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, makes sense.
It's gonna rain, children, it's gonna rain. You better get ready and bear this in mind. God sure knows. Showed him a rainbow sign. He said it won't be war.
For listeners who really like this week's album, if you want to move on to something else, we have some recommendations for what should be next in your playlist. Morgan?
Gosh, I would say two places. I would say get into the Davis Sisters. Find the best of the Davis Sisters.
Well, I'm crying,
so I'd say get into the best of the Davis Sisters. There's fire on that, the good fire.
Good fire.
and then get into 1967's The Kings of Gospel. And I would say start with the song "I'm Going Down in Jesus' Name." That one there is fire.
I'm going down in my Jesus' name. I mean what I'm saying.
I'm going down in my Jesus' name.
Lord, I don't care.
I don't care what the world says about me.
Oh, yes, I am.
I'm going down in Jesus' name.
Partly in honor of Van Hunt, I went with one of my favorite gospel soul albums, which is from a group from Dayton. They're called the Daytonians. They had an album that came out in 1977 called Jesus Will Work It Out, which just coincidentally, I did not realize this until today, it got re-released this year. So what used to be a relatively obscure LP is now a little bit more available. And another coincidence, it was, even though the group is from Dayton, it was the album itself was recorded in Atlanta for Church Door Records out there. The LP features gospelified versions of songs by the Byrds and Bob Dylan, but for me, it is all about the title track, which is just a sublime masterpiece of soulful simplicity. Mm.
Sometimes I'm gaining.
And speaking of Jesus Will Work It Out, Jesus Will Work It Out is an old gospel song, like I said, Gospel 101, and came to prominence over a big gospel song by Dr. Charles Hayes and the Cosmopolitan Church of Prayer Choir.
Oh, your money's been a little bit to buy the food. The baby need a pair of shoes.
The crux of the song is the breakdown over the many things that Jesus will work out for you, the many dilemmas. And it focused on, say you got a gas bill due or something, you got a light bill too, which ended up becoming a smash house record last year by DJ Charisma.
Wow.
And it focused on that one line. And I saw people dancing to that at the House Music Festival in Atlanta a couple years ago, and people were losing it all on the dance floor to that one. Both the churchy folks and people that were like, this is fire. the good fire. got to the point, gospel music belongs to generations of folks.
So, Van, besides the obvious answer to this question, which would be people should listen to your covers of the songs off of It's Gonna Rain Again, what would you recommend people listen to next if they really liked this particular album?
Well, a couple of things. So, Good Fire is Heat Rocks. Is that what we're doing?
Right? Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Just making sure.
Yeah.
And in another twist of fate, my uncle actually worked with the Daytonians.
Mm.
Wow.
Yeah. So, that's just crazy. I would say Jesus Gave Me Water with Sam Cooke and Soul Stirrers. It's a perfect place to begin.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy, and Sam's voice just bounces. So lovely over the music.
Well, there was a woman from Samaria came to the well to get some water. There she met a stranger who did a story tell that a woman dropped a pitcher.
That will do it for this episode of Heat Rocks with our guest, Van Hunt. Well, I think we already know what you're working on now, but in addition to sort of your gospel covers, what else are you working on?
Oh, I'm working on a lot of music, a lot of new music. For myself and for other artists. I just finished working with Corey Henry on his EP for his band, and that was super exciting.
I meant to ask, since we're on the topic of God here, the name of your indie label is Godless Hotspot, which sounds like a blasphemous, perhaps, Wi-Fi network, but where does that name come from?
Probably just being the same mischievous, provocative provocateur I've always been, trying to see if I can bring a frown to my mother's face. But there is a tagline. It says, "Godless Hotspot." Whether for believers and non-believers alike, everyone can agree that any spot without God must be hot.
There you go.
I love it.
Where can people find more about you online?
Oh, anywhere. I'm ubiquitous. Go to Instagram or the Gram or IG, whatever.
It's all Van Hunt.
Yeah.
And you have your own website, I believe, at vanhunt.com as well,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly.
You've been listening to Heat Rocks with me, Oliver Wong, and Morgan Rhodes.
Our theme music is Crown Ones by Thess One of People Under the Stairs. Shout out to Thess for the hookup.
Heat Rocks is produced by myself and Morgan, alongside Christian Duenas, who also edits, engineers, and does the booking for our shows.
Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and our executive producer is Jesse Thorne.
We are part of the Maximum Fun family, taping every week live in their studios in the Westlake neighborhood of Los Angeles, where I would joke that it never rains, except that it just did earlier this week. We want to thank all of our 5-star iTunes reviewers, the latest being Porky Party, who called us, quote, very informative and fun, unquote, and requested an episode about a Morris Day and Time album. I'm with that. Let's see if that happens. If you have not had a chance yet to leave us a review, please, please consider doing so, because it is a fundamental way in which people can find their way to our podcast who haven't listened to us before, and it just takes you a few seconds.
We also wanted to thank all of our social media fans and family out there, including these folks. We want to shout out Exclamation. KC Exclamation, that's cool, who really enjoyed Saul Williams coming on here and talking about Portishead's Dummy. We also want to thank Gregory the Eye for the same at Driven to Drink, Warm Warmer Disco, and also just in general, we just want to shout out our social media fans who have the best Twitter handles ever. You know what I mean? So shout out to them. Shout out to Dan Jite. We also want to thank Jeffrey M. Norton, Cooper Levy Baker, Dr. VZ. All right, Dr. VZ. Mental Masala. See, that's what I'm talking about. These names here. Trevor Cunning. Vitrified Man. shout out to you. We also want to thank Jazz Register to Vote. Okay, shout out. And Dr. Frederick Smith. We also want to include Fuzz T1 and Lost in Williamsburg. We do so appreciate the Tweezies and the retweezies. Good to see you, Oliver.
Good to see you too, Morgan.
One last thing. Here's a teaser for next week's episode, which features my conversation with Watts Prophets co-founder, Father Amdi, talking about Marvin Gaye's What's Going On.
And he was so far ahead. I mean, you can go through that song and see all of the same things that he's talking about or accelerated or exaggerate are much more than they was when Marvin was talking about it. He was sort of like a prophet and giving us a picture of what's going on. We finally begin to figure it out what actually was going on in it. Sometimes it seems like if we are being evicted from Earth, and he understood that. He understood pain. He always put feeling into everything that he did, and he was very serious about it. And as I said, many of these songs live in the library of people's minds.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.